It's 8:12. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Stay tuned. In a few minutes, we'll be checking in with Park City Chamber Bureau and President CEO Bill Malone, as well as his successor, Jennifer Wesselhoff. We'll be talking about his retirement and then the selection of his replacement. Later on in the hour, Garrick Peterson is the Director of Academics for the Wasatch County School District. He'll be telling us about the opening of schools this week, their COVID-19 mitigation, talking a little bit about enrollment, as well as how it's all affecting the budget. Stay tuned. Well, KPCW's summer pledge drive, as you know, ended yesterday, and I know a relief for many of you, us as well, but it raised more than $200,000 for your public radio station. So we'd just like to thank everyone who donated, all of the volunteers who helped us with the four-day fundraiser. We're also grateful to the more than 50 of you who represented some 27 different organizations, each sponsoring an hour of our pledge drive. As a result of your efforts, some 17 nonprofits will get more than $50,000 of free underwriting on this radio station. It's part of our mission here at KPCW. We help other nonprofits spread the word about the good work they do in our community. So when you donate, you not only support our local news reporting, the public affairs programming, NPR, and great music, you are also helping other nonprofit organizations. It's especially meaningful to see the support for KPCW during this pandemic. We have, of course, expanded our services during COVID-19 to keep our community informed. Your donations help us to continue serving Summit and Wasatch counties, and we want to extend a big thank you to everyone who donated. I'm certainly very thankful and humbled by those who helped raise nearly $40,000 yesterday during the local news hour in honor of my 30th anniversary here at the station. So again, a big thank you, and onward to year 31. The Utah legislature yesterday voted to repeal the controversial language in House Bill 359. An amendment added to House Bill 359 during the legislature's 2020 general session allowed the town of Hideout to annex the Richardson Flat property in Summit County without the county's consent. KPCW's Sean Higgins has the details.
The Utah legislature acted swiftly on Thursday to repeal the controversial language in House Bill 359 that briefly allowed municipalities in Utah to annex unincorporated land without consent from the affected counties. The new legislation is called House Bill 6007 and passed with near-unanimous support from both the Utah House and Senate. House Bill 6007 passed the House with a 65-10 vote and the Senate 28-1, with only Senator Dan McKay of Riverton voting no. House Bill 359 was originally written to address a specific circumstance in a different part of the state, and its substitute amendment faced allegations of misrepresentation during the legislative process. The town of Hideout in Wasatch County used the amended bill to vote to begin the annexation process of 655 acres of land in Summit County, known as Richardson Flat, without Summit County's consent on July 9th. These allegations led lawmakers to reconsider the legislation during Thursday's special session. Summit County sued Hideout over the annexation move in late July, and the Hideout Town Council voted to repeal their annexation plans on August 14th. A ruling on the lawsuit is currently pending in Utah's 4th District Court. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher tells KPCW Thursday's repeal will be to the benefit of counties across the state.
Certainly, the action by the legislature to repeal was certainly something that we were looking for. Not only for ourselves, but for other counties and around the state, because we thought that there was some unintended consequences to that substitute that was offered during the regular session and adopted.
Hideout originally moved to annex the Richardson Flat land for use as a commercial development area for the town. Hideout officials say the town is in need of services to address the expected growth around the Jordan Reservoir in the coming years. Fisher extended an olive branch to Hideout on Thursday and says Summit County is looking forward to working with Hideout on land use matters in the future.
The town of Hideout also, in some of their open meetings couple of weeks, certain members of their town council have expressed, you know, a willingness to work on the specific issues that were brought forth by this annexation that they were expressing, and we look forward to really working on those with them as we get past this current situation.
In a text message to KPCW on Thursday evening, Hideout Mayor Phil Rubin said the town is disappointed but believes their efforts brought awareness to the needs for goods, services, and affordable housing in the Jordanelle area. Rubin added the town is looking forward to working with the various parties involved in order to meet those needs. KPCW learned late on Thursday that a ruling on Summit County's lawsuit against Hideout that was originally scheduled for Friday, August 21st, has been postponed. Hideout is arguing the lawsuit is now moot based on the town's repeal of the original annexation resolution on August 14th. Summit County has until August 28th to respond, according to the court order. House Bill 6007 will become law in 60 days, and a link to read the full bill can be found on our website, kpcw.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, as we've reported, the Board of Directors of the Park City Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau has selected Jennifer Wesselhoff of Sedona, Arizona, to take over the reins from Bill Malone, who has served in that role for the last 21 years now. They both join me now in the studio. Good morning, and congratulations to both of you, Bill, on your retirement, and Jennifer on your appointment. When do you officially take over?
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. My first day is going to be October 19th.
Okay. And then, Bill, you are staying on until she gets here.
Until about 8 o'clock that morning when she shows up, and then I'll just find my way out the door.
Yeah. So the two of you, though, have worked together before.
Yeah, it's so ironic that, there was a national search conducted, and we had lots of candidates, I understand. I wasn't a part of the search, but we had a great committee that ran this, and when they told me that they had hired Jennifer, I was very pleased, because I've known Jennifer for better than 10 years. We've worked, we've both served as chair of Destination Marketing Association of the West. We've served on committees on national associations trying to elevate the industry of our profession. And so it was exciting for me to hear that Jennifer is coming here, because Jennifer runs an organization that's quite similar to ours, mm-hmm. in structure and mechanisms, mm-hmm. and staffing.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer, then tell us a little bit about yourself and why you wanted to leave the vortex and come to Park City.
I've always admired Bill's work here in Park City. Like he said, our organizations are very similar. And surprisingly, our destinations are very similar as well. Similar populations. Tourism is the economic generator in both of our communities, $1 billion industry, 10,000 jobs. So I've always admired Park City. Honestly, I wasn't looking for a new job, but when the opportunity came to explore Park City, I was very excited to do so, because it's really the only place that I would consider moving and calling home. So a little bit about myself. I've been in my position for 13 years in Sedona, at the organization for just about 20. And my husband and I, just us, will be moving here in mid-October.
Yeah. Is there something to the vortex in Sedona? Can you talk just a minute about that? I mean, is it true?
I wasn't expecting that question.
Well, I've always wondered. I've been there, and I was like, I kind of missed it, but I don't know. Maybe it's true.
I think a lot of people feel something special in destinations like Sedona and Park City, and a lot of that is just the openness of the place. But Native Americans believe that Sedona was sacred land, and they still do. And that's where that concept of the vortex comes from. It's the special energy that you feel when you're in that place. So some people feel it, some people don't. I always just feel something special in those places, because I think, like you feel here in Park City, you feel small in such big nature and big sky and big space. And that gives such interesting perspective to life in general. And that's what I love about being outdoors and being in the nature.
Yeah. And Sedona, it's what, between Phoenix and Flagstaff, basically. So in the mountains, a little bit cooler than certainly Phoenix.
Absolutely.
But not as nice as Flagstaff.
Right, exactly. We like to consider ourselves the heart of the state. We're halfway between Phoenix and the Grand Canyon. We're at about 4,500 feet, so quite cooler than Phoenix. Not as cool as Park City or Flagstaff, but I'm looking forward to enjoying some snow.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the sustainable tourism plan that you developed for Sedona. It was something. It is something that has been discussed here in Park City.
It is, and I was looking forward to the Park City tour coming to Sedona in September. Unfortunately, that had to be postponed. To learn more about our sustainable tourism plan, really the focus of that plan was to try to answer the question, how much is too much? Are we loving Sedona to death? What does the future of our quality of life and our environment and our economy look like? And how do we balance all of those things? Tourism is such an important part of our community. And most of the people, like I think here in Park City, moved to Sedona because they wanted to be there. So it's a different perspective when you're working with residents who have chosen to live in a place. So we really wanted to try to tackle some of the pinch points that tourism brought while maintaining our high economic industry. So it was really important to balance that. So we looked at it differently. We decided that we needed to find out what the residents like, what they don't like, and how can we use the power of our influence with our businesses. We have about 900 members at our chamber. I know Bill has about 1,000 in Park City. How can we use our influence with them to impact and change visitor behavior? And how can we use our impact with visitors to change the way that they view nature and the environment and to become better stewards of our land?
Yeah, so how did you specifically balance then those competing interests? I mean, certainly as Chamber CEO, you're representing our businesses, our lodging and local businesses, and yet residents feel like they're being overrun right by the work you're doing. So, I mean, what's that healthy balance between a strong economy and not feeling like we need to have everybody here?
First of all, everything that we did was based in research. So the first part of the study was really understanding what do our businesses need, what do they want, what do they see the future, and asking those same questions of our residents, which was the first time that we really asked those hard questions of our residents. And then our visitors were also part of that research study. And from that, I think it's the same probably here in Park City, that there's way more that we agree on than we disagree on. So identifying the trade-offs and looking at the positives of the industry and understanding and being honest that there are negatives in every industry, how can we mitigate some of those? And that's really where the great work is happening now, looking at things that we can change for the positive benefit of our residents.
Yeah, but did you talk about like putting caps on numbers or only increasing growth by a certain amount or event-free months or things like that?
I mean, absolutely. Those are always part of the conversation. I think it's important for residents to understand how and what businesses need to operate to be successful year-round, and trying to find that middle ground and build consensus on the way to move forward. And I think our organization was really successful in educating and informing and finding that middle ground on the best way to protect the environment, the quality of life, and the businesses. And it's so important for people to know that we're residents too, and quality of life is important for us.
Yeah. So do we have money for this, Bill? I mean, the organization funded with lodging taxes, mm-hmm. and as we've seen, I don't know, the summer's actually been pretty good. I mean, I think we took a real hit, but maybe you can give us an update on that.
Sure. I mean, just like any organization, this is a really challenging year, to see what's happening. I think the view and the picture of what's going on economically is probably better than the reality of it right now, because we lost so much of our summer business that was corporate business, meetings, and that's, the effect of that. When I look at, nearly 2,500 jobs that are missing right now in town, and that's painful. And so it's a slow road out of this. It's not a quick turnaround and flip the switch and it's all going to be better. So it you know, we learn more every day. But in general, I'd say our summer right now is half of what our summer was at this time last year. So there's from a financial standpoint, we'll be more challenged moving forward. We'll have to be pretty judicious in how we spend the dollars and what are we doing that we don't make short-term decisions that affect us in the long run. One of the examples of that I love is to see right now we're selling meetings in 21 and 22. And so that's important that we do that, that we fill that backlog and not just react to it now and say, well, we don't have any meetings, we stop that function. So there's a lot of flexibility, and I think what you'll find is that the CEO and Jennifer being the new CEO will have that ability to tweak the organization and shift priorities in different ways. And I think that's a lot of what the search committee was looking for in selecting Jennifer, was not just, you know, picking up where what Bill does and continuing what Bill did. I think it's time for change.
And it's such a challenging time right now. I think the focus really needs to be on business recovery, getting those folks back to work, supporting our businesses so that they can stay in business. Because our business owners are our residents and our neighbors, and we need to get them back to where they were and really supporting the economy and the employees who need to be working right now.
Okay, so Bill, what's next for you? You've already got your shorts and sweatshirts on.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I'm not going anywhere. I'll be looking for some work. Might see me on the slopes or at the golf course.
Oh, good for you. Yeah, and any advice for Jennifer?
Just be yourself. You know, I've known Jennifer, like I said, for a long time. Very impressed with her work. She's recognized throughout the industry as a hard worker and a smart person. So I don't think our organization could have done much better than selecting Jennifer.
Yeah. Again, congratulations. Hey, I just wanted to ask you too, because I had heard just this week about the lodging that we're kind of seeing where people are renting out units, not for just a couple of nights, but like month long. Is
Correct.
That what's happening?
Yeah. And you know, I think that's part of what we were just talking about, is that maybe it's giving the appearance that we're a little bit healthier than we are, because the reality is when somebody's here for two months, renting a 2-bedroom unit with their family for 2 months to escape somewhere else, that's great. They're here, they're spending money, but the reality is they don't spend money like they're on vacation. You know, so the you know, they're not going fly fishing and renting bikes every day when they're here for 2 months. They're working, they're going to the grocery store, they're buying groceries, they're cooking food, they're not going out to dinner all the time. So while we see these people and we play this license plate game, you know, and see all these different, oh, look at the California plates and Oregon plates, et cetera, the reality is that behavior is not typical of what juices our economy in the summer.
Okay. Well, we'll get to have you in again before you take off and just kind of have a winter outlook. And
sure.
We'll look forward to talking to you in the future. Jennifer, again, congratulations,
Thank
guys.
You.
Thanks for coming
Thank
in. You,
you
get the honor of being the first people to return to the studio. Yeah.
Great.
All right. I look forward to many more.
In studio, interview. So great.
Thank you.
Bill Malone, Jennifer Wesselhoff. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. We'll be checking in with Garrick Peterson right after this. Well, as we've reported, the Wasatch County School District welcomed back students on Monday on the phone with an update of how things are going. I have Garrick Peterson. He is the school district's director of academics. Good morning, Garrick. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning.
So tell us, how is it going?
It's going great so far. You know, this is Friday of our first week, full weekend. About 4 days down, the kids have come back happy, teachers have come back happy, a lot of energy. You know, the excitement of the first day of school was there. And so far, according to the data that we track, the kids we've brought them back healthy, but we'll see how that goes as we continue.
Yeah. Can you talk to me a little bit? What's the percent of population back in class versus those who may have chosen to do an online study program or a homeschool?
Yeah, so we gave our parents three options, and we have about 85% roughly that are back full-time. They chose to bring their kids back all day. We've got about another 7-8% that have their kids back in halftime. They've got their kids in school for their core classes, math and language arts, science, social studies, and then they're doing elective classes at home online. And then we've got about 7% that have chosen to do our online program. So most of the kids are in school. Almost all kids are in school at some point of the day, and then we do have a group that's doing online only.
Oh, okay. And then, so the online only, are they just tuning in when they would be in class so that the teacher doesn't need to make any kind of additional video learning videos for them?
Yeah. So what we have is we have online teachers. We have a group of 10 or so online teachers in the district, and they have if you look at the numbers that are in there, it's about one class per elementary grade level in the district. So those teachers take that class of around 30 kids, and they work the same curriculum that we would be giving them in the regular class, same standards they're going after, same assessments, and they have their own teacher, and that teacher checks in with them, teaches them online. So our teachers aren't doing both. We either have online teachers or in class teachers. Those kids that are doing online, they'll do more Canvas course. They'll have curriculum on there. We do have the capability. We have cameras in our system that do video teachers, especially in our secondary core areas, so that we can record our teachers teaching in the classroom and then upload that onto those Canvas courses so they can see our teachers teaching. So just a combination of things that are helping those kids that are online learn.
Yeah, interesting. So what about like the most vulnerable in the district, those English language learners, the special ed students? Certainly they need more help. Are they able to get it?
Yeah, so the kids that need additional support, well, there's a couple of concerns we have coming into the year. One is that group. They're it's a challenge anyway because English isn't their first language or they have a learning disability. Those kids, most of them are running in our full-time program, which means they're going to get our full support. They've got access to everything that they did before as far as language in a fairly normal way. For those kids that sit in that population that have chosen either the halftime or online, we definitely do have the accommodations. For them, they're a little bit different than they would receive in the regular classroom, but we do have some supports for them. Another group that we're concerned about are those students. We're pretty tight. You know, if a kid's showing symptoms, they don't come of having the COVID virus, that they don't come into the school. And so if they're home for a day or two because they have symptoms, but maybe, they don't test positive, or if they're quarantined because of family member, but they're feeling good, that we're able to deliver services to those kids too. And so we've got some things set up to make sure that those kids continue to learn at home if they're feeling good enough to continue to learn. So again, working through those online Canvas courses that match what we're doing in the classroom will be a bigger thing than ever throughout this year, and that'll be something that'll be quite different than we've done before.
Yeah. Are students required to submit any kind of online wellness check each day before school?
Every day. So the kind of our kind of practice is we ask our parents to screen every morning before their kids come to school. And really what we've done is we've asked this to not be done out of compliance, but more out of vision. You know, we've got three goals in our district this year. One is to make sure that none of our teachers contract the virus while at work. We got to keep them safe. Our kids learn better when our teachers are there. Second one is to make sure none of our schools or classrooms get closed down or be put online. If we're going to do those first two well, then we got to make sure that kids aren't in our school sick, that we're all working on this together. It's not just a school goal. This is a community goal, and our parents have been phenomenal in doing their part there. The third goal is that our kids learn every essential thing that we want them to learn. That's done best when our teachers are there and our kids are there. So with that, one of the things that we do is also once the kids get there, if a kid complains of having nauseous or one of those symptoms of COVID, they come down, we look at the kid, and we will ask them to go home for a day until they don't show symptoms. So, you know, we're doing some of those things to make sure that our teachers are safe, that our students are safe, our schools stay open, and that we can continue to learn.
Yeah. What's the situation with teachers? Do you have enough? I mean, what have you seen in terms of retirements and resignations coming into the school year?
Yeah, we saw a few. Everyone's processing this differently, and you want to give room for everyone to process this differently, depending on their home situation, their personal situation. And we did have a few retirements, not very many. We did have some teachers that they wanted to be an online teacher. They're a little bit concerned. We've had teachers that wanted to teach the half-day classes because those class sizes are smaller and more spread out. And for the most part, I think we've been able to meet the desires of every teacher and put them in a situation where they feel safe, that they're excited to come back to school, not fearful. I think for the most part, we've been able to accommodate that.
Yeah, and we certainly heard about the overcrowding at the high school before COVID hit. How are you assuring that there is safe social distancing happening there?
Yeah, high schools are tough on this one. Just the social nature of high school kids. During class, we do pretty well. And then what you try to do where in the hallways, lunchtime, some of those common space times, is you just try to keep a flow going through the school. And again, the kids have been phenomenal. Coming back, they've been, you know, things that we were worried about. Will the kids wear a mask? The kids have been so compliant with those kinds of things. And really, the kids, I think, just want to be in school. They want to be safe. They want to be open. So this first week, pretty much anything that we've asked them to do on that front, they've been so willing to do. And I think it comes back to they don't want to go back online like they did the last 2 months last year. So when we ask that a flow keep going in a school or that lunchroom, they keep some distance between themselves, they've been very responsive to that, very impressed with our student body at all grade levels and how they've responded coming back.
Yeah. Do you have any preliminary enrollment numbers on par? I mean, are you basically on par with what was budgeted? I mean, we heard in here in Park City School District some 200 new students that weren't anticipated.
Yeah, so the initial look at that, our high school enrollment is up. We just continue. The valley's growing, and numbers keep growing there. And really in this valley, where we see a lot of that growth is in our high school area. Our elementaries are pretty steady, and our middle schools are going up as well. We see a lot of families coming in that have more of the older kids, and we just continue to see those numbers go up. Of course, when you pull out, 7% for online, that does take enrollment down inside the school a little bit. So that's helped with a little bit, but not a lot, because most of our kids are in school every day.
Yeah. So any update then on building a new high school? Of course, the bond wasn't approved last election, and certainly nothing on for this ballot, I'm guessing just because of the situation we've got. But any plans for moving forward with a new high school?
Yeah, I know our school board is always considering those things. I don't think the growth in the valley is going to stop. I think people have found the magic of the Wasatch back, and I think it's a very desirable place to live, and I think we'll continue to see that growth. So where that goes, our board will reflect on that and make some decisions there.
Okay. Let's see. What about the buses? Are students riding the buses, or are we seeing more traffic out there with parents doing carpools and things like that?
Yeah, kids are riding the buses just like I was just having a conversation last night with a bus driver after school board meeting. Kids are on the buses. They come in. We do some things there, like try to sit kids with their siblings. They're in assigned seats so that if we need to contact trace, if somebody tests positive, we know who they've been sitting by. So they sanitize their hands getting on the bus. They sanitize their hands getting off the bus. Bus drivers wipe down in between. So those things we're doing to try to make it as safe as possible. But the buses are operating as usual. In fact, we're looking for a couple of bus drivers to fill a couple of routes right now, which we are every year. That's always a tough position to fill, to fully staff. So if anybody out there wants to drive a bus, we've got a couple openings in Wasatch District. But, yeah, we've made things safe, and things are fairly normal. Kids are getting on the bus fairly normal. They're going to class fairly normal. The excitement's normal. It's been a really good start this week.
Yeah. And, of course, Miners going down to the Wasps last weekend. How did that football game go? Did you get any updates on it, or were you there?
Yeah, the football game went well. So, again, you just do things a little bit differently. And we work very closely with the Wasatch County Health Department on all activities like that. And so never done before at a football game. Every person that came to the game had to have a ticket, sit in assigned seat, wear masks. Those were things that kids, usually if you come to a Wasatch High School football game, you got a lot of middle schoolers and elementary kids running around, not in a seat, but just kind of maybe playing a football game in the end zone or whatever. But this year that didn't happen. You either had a ticket with an assigned seat, or you weren't in the game. And then we had people wear masks. But besides that, the game kind of went off. You know, there's rules from the High School Activities Association, how many players can be on the sidelines. So just some different tightening things like that. But besides that, it was a great event. Very, very fun thing to be back and part of.
Great. Anything else, Garrick, you wanted to share with our listeners?
You know, we're extremely excited to be back. We feel like we planned well, but we're going to learn as we go. And there's data that we're tracking to kind of inform us. Right now, all of that looks good, but this will be schools have never dealt with this before, just like everybody else, whether you're a business or a school. You open up and then you start learning a few things, and I'm sure we'll learn a few things along the way. But it's just exciting to have kids back in school, teachers back in school, bus drivers driving buses, lunch workers serving lunches. It's just fun to be a part of right now. I think when something goes away for a while, you appreciate it even more, and so we're just excited to be back.
Okay, Garrick Peterson is the Director of Academics for the Wasatch County School District. Appreciate your time, and stay safe.
Thank you so much.
KPCW News Time now, 8:46. And just a heads up that KPCW will be carrying the Park City High School football game live tonight. Kickoff time, of course, 7 o'clock. Miners taking on Juan Diego here at Dozier Field. Pete Gilwald and Craig Elliott will be calling the game for KPCW, bringing back the old school guys. So great to hear them back on the air together. And again, the ticketing process for that is different. So if it's something you wanted to be in person, you'll need to figure that out. But again, just stay at home, back porch, and enjoy the game right here on KPCW. Well, taking a look at some local news now, the Summit County Health Department says that a Park City private party a couple of weeks ago apparently led to a significant increase in new COVID-19 cases. The health department posted a message on their Facebook page yesterday. It says that a surge in cases began to appear after a private party took place in early August where face coverings were not widely used. The notice says that most cases remain in western Summit County and are occurring in young adults ages 25 to 44. The statement said that they are continuing case investigations and contact tracing, but they can confidently report that the surge is not associated with the opening of schools. The health department said about the party, "This should be a reminder that the irresponsible actions of a few can place our communities, our businesses, residents, and visitors at risk." Monarch butterfly populations have declined by more than 99% since the 1980s. Millions have disappeared in the past 40 years, and it's projected that there are 30,000 left just in the western U.S. Wasatch and Summit County citizen scientists can help identify monarchs as they complete the late summit migration south. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more about that.
This is the time of year for monarch butterflies to migrate through Utah on the way to coastal areas of California and Oregon, where they spend the winter. Drought, pesticides, habitat depletion, and other unknown causes have impacted the populations to the extent that the iconic bright orange and black monarch butterfly may be listed on the endangered species designation in December. The designation could determine how insect habitat is protected across the nation. Rare Insects Conservation Officer Amanda Barth is with the Utah Department of Natural Resources. She says citizen scientists are the lifeblood of their efforts to address the dramatic decline in population over the past four decades. They want to learn more about monarch breeding and habitat. She says people can get involved through several programs such as Utah Pollinator Pursuit, Southwest Monarchs, and Monarchs of the Wasatch.
There are people who agree to use a certain collector app for their phone. Some people are using iNaturalist Monarch Project. We at the state partnered with Wild Utah Project, reach as many volunteers as Wild Utah Project has access to, and have people report their observation of monarchs at all life stages, as well as bumblebees, because we are also seeing massive declines of bumblebees across the West.
While monarchs are migrating and breeding in this part of Utah, Barth says citizen scientists can submit their observations, which will be used by her team to learn more about the insects.
And then they spend the growing season, these nice wildflower months when milkweed are growing all over the West, breeding and multiplying and staying warm. And then the days get shorter. Rather than mate, they start storing fat and they start migrating back towards California and Oregon.
Barth says one of the best ways to help the monarch is to preserve milkweed, which is often found on roadsides or in pastures. She says milkweed is poisonous to cattle, so ranchers eradicate the plant.
It's a common thread among a lot of these insect declines is just habitat loss and pesticide. You know, the way we use the land, the way we damage it, and the damage we leave is really... The monarch butterflies are the most recognizable or one of the most charismatic species, you know, and the loss of this charismatic species has alerted people to the issue of pollinator decline. And there are some being spotted in Summit County. There are boggy lakes that are stream-fed, you know, river-fed. If you're seeing big patches of milkweed, those monarchs know about that milkweed too.
As a rare insect specialist, Barth says she has spent a lot of time looking for habitat, but she says it's difficult because there hasn't been a monsoon season this year and it's been very dry. Planting flowers in backyards and gardens is another way to help preserve insect habitat. To get involved in citizen science programs, go to kpcw.org for links to monarch butterfly websites. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
A public hearing hosted by the Summit County Council on Wednesday on a proposed neighborhood mixed-use zone turned into a lengthy discussion. Several speakers appeared at the electronic meeting to say that the new designation might become a spur to growth or encourage misbehavior. In response, county officials said the proposal does not rezone anything or create new entitlements. As KPCW's Rick Bruff reports, the council continued the proposal to a meeting next month.
The county council heard from 10 people about the Neighborhood Mixed-Use Zone, or NMU for short. The proposal has been spurred by developer Henry Sid, who wants to build a prototype along the Highway 40 frontage road near Home Depot. However, the proposal also comes with a revision of the Snyderville future land use map with areas marked in red where an NMU development might happen. Among the comments, Kathy Mears said she's been lately drawn back into growth issues because of items like the Dakota Pacific proposal at Kimball Junction and the development considered by Hideout as an annexation into Summit County. Now she said the NMU proposal has her wondering.
None of this seems to be being viewed in a holistic manner, but rather making these potential zones, and let's just say all those zones eventually got approved for some type of multi-use development. Are we talking residents of like maybe 10 to 15,000 more people on top of what's already going to happen at Silver Creek Junction and what's happening because of Wasatch County?
Mary Krista Smith did not object so much to the areas marked now as possible mixed-use areas, but she asked what kind of unintended consequences might happen elsewhere.
And when I look at the thoughtfulness of the zones in red, personally, in general, I'm in alignment with those. But what I'm concerned about is a developer coming in, requesting a zone change to a mixed use area, and then being able to apply the NMU in places that are not outlined in this map.
Another speaker, former county commissioner and county council member Sally Elliott, said she sees a lot of potential for growth, abuse, and misbehavior. In reply, County Council Chairman Doug Clyde said that there's absolutely nothing in the plan that says these areas will be rezoned. He told Elliott that they could only be considered for a change in zoning.
If you read the general plan, you would realize, and you do know this actually, it is chocked full of verbiage about the fact that we already have more units than we can shake a stick at. And so it's very hard under the current general plan to come up with a convincing argument that you should be allowed to upzone. And I agree, if we were zoning this, the potential abuse would be, for all intents and purposes, unlimited. But we're not. We're not rezoning. All we're doing is showing the citizens of the county what future land uses may look like.
I clearly understand, Mr. Clyde. I have been involved in this since before I first knew you. So give me a break here and give me a few more weeks to think about this.
Clyde said any rezone would have to get over the hurdle of Provision 2.3 in the Snyderville Code, which says the county cannot create new growth unless the applicant shows a compelling public benefit. Clyde said they also received a letter from Park City Municipal asking that the city's annexation areas be excluded from any possibility of a mixed-use zone. However, Clyde and Deputy County Attorney Dave Thomas said that legally they cannot forbid any landowner from requesting a rezone. Council member Roger Armstrong said he was hearing a lot of fear in the comments Wednesday, but the NMU is just a tool to give them better control over development. Still, the council heard from Miles Radiman, who said he was agitated, like a lot of other people, by the apparent new reality. He said while the NMU plan is not a rezoning, it is a pre-zoning.
I would just be very cautious about this because the developers, again, that we face, and we will face a deluge of them, who are very well financed, who want to, in a way, parasite off of the great planning and the open space bonds we passed and the trails we put in. They really, you know, are coming to take advantage of that. And they're proposing very, very high urban densities in order to make their things pencil out for themselves. So I'm just suggesting to my elected representatives, who I love and trust, be very skeptical of the pretty pictures, of the great words, of all the things that we think will happen, because in reality, it doesn't always work out the way it is on the plan.
Park City visioning activist Miles Radiman. The council voted to continue discussion of the proposal to their meeting on September 9th. For KPCW, I'm Rick Baroff.
Morning Edition and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you in part by Intermountain Park City Hospital, Intermountain Heber City Hospital, and the Red Ledges Community.
And the Heber City Council voted to adopt a new street banner policy at their meeting Tuesday. The city was accused of taking sides on a political issue after pride banners were flown on Heber's Main Street the last two summers. The new banner ordinance was adopted unanimously by the Heber City Council, now sets new regulations for what can and cannot be displayed on street banners flown throughout the town. Heber came under fire during Pride Month last June after rainbow-colored banners that read Pride in the Wasatch Back flew down Heber's Main Street. LGBTQ Pride banners also flew on Heber's Main Street this June, and the city faced accusations of taking sides on what a number of citizens consider to be a political issue. Following the backlash and requests for a number of banners in response to the Pride message, the Heber City Council began the process of reevaluating the banner policy at the end of last year. The council hoped to further clarify the language around what the city will allow to be on the banners and to determine whether or not banners are part of a public forum for free speech. As was the case at many other city council meetings addressing Heber's banner policy, public comment was almost entirely focused on the Pride banners in particular on Tuesday. While the Pride banners were what drew attention to Heber's banner policy, City Councilmember Mike Johnson said this ordinance is not because the banners, nor an effort to prevent them from ever being flown in Heber City in the future.
The overriding premise on this was not because of the actual Pride banners and the Pride flags, which I quite enjoyed. It was the ugly response to them. We don't actually have a way to prevent the ugliness and the reply banners that were offered in response to the Pride banners. And so we really feel that we need to come together and put something in place that pulls this back into the government speech rather than private speech. So I do want to make it clear that I do not feel like I'm voting for an ordinance because of the Pride banners. It's actually because of the ugly reply to the Pride banners and the things that's bringing forward.
The adopted ordinance states that street banners are not part of a public forum and can be regulated by the city. Banners are now restricted to the promotion of federal and state holidays, as well as events and messages sponsored by Heber, Wasatch County, or the Heber Valley Chamber of Commerce that are deemed not-for-profit and non-political. City Attorney Mark Smedley did say that the language of the ordinance does allow for some wiggle room. He said if the city, county, or chamber of commerce wants to sponsor an LGBTQ event or something similar in the future and promote it on street banners, that the city council now has the authority to do that. Again, the Heber City Council passed the banner ordinance with a 5-0 vote. The full ordinance can be found on our website, kpcw.org.